aliens and flying saucers.
This is all an illusion. Please pardon the confusion.
Hey. Welcome to the 16th episode of Two Writers Slinging Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers, and a columnist for The Athletic, as well as a Bleacher Report contributor. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the great MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novels to romance to comics to whatever I'm thinking of. And today's guest is Tom Juno, an 11-time finalist and a 2-time winner of the National Magazine Award. Tom is a longtime and legendary Esquire writer who's now at ESPN, and he's the author of The Falling Man, one of the single greatest pieces of writing reporting you'll ever see, as well as about a zillion other breathtaking journalistic masterpieces that I'll never touch. So let's talk the art and crafting of journalistic masterpieces that I'll never touch right now on Two Writers Slinging Yang. So Tom, I am it's funny, I actually brought you here. I mean, I brought you here for a lot of reasons, but two episodes ago, I had Wright Thompson on, and great writer, and his sort of thing, he was talking about different stories throughout history, and he was saying, you know, I'm not really intimidated by that story, and I'm not intimidated by that story, but I'm intimidated by The Falling Man. I don't think he used the word intimidated, but overwhelmed by The Falling Man. And I'm going to ask you a weird question about this before I get into it a little. You wrote that story 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I have people, my first book was a biography of the 86 Mets, and I have people come up to me and say, oh, that book, tell me about that book. And it seems like I wrote it so long ago that I don't feel the same connection to it now that I did at the time. And I wonder when people say to you, and I know you hear it often, that story just did it for me, or that story, does it feel fresh and new and part of you, or does it feel like something that happened so long ago that it's a different piece of your life?
Well, I mean, I'll say right off the bat that, I mean, I'm intimidated by The Falling Man. You know what I mean? I mean, that's
no, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Well, no, well, that story was just one of those things. I mean, it's not even lightning striking. It's, you know, this odd voice sort of dictating itself to you as you go. And you're just, you know, you're working hard at it, obviously, and stuff. But I mean, I was just sort of writing it down, and you know, once it was done, I couldn't imagine like doing that again. You know, it's so, you know, and I think that to me, all great stories are that way. You know, I mean, there's just this, you know, they sort of, you rise to their moment, or they rise to your moment. And you know, there's so many different factors that are determining, you know, the outcome, that you just really have no idea whether you can do that again. I mean, I'm starting to write a book right now, and you know, you want that to happen. I mean, you want to be able to sort of write in a way that is completely suitable to the task and the occasion. But, you know, you're writing a book, and that's, you know, it's like a year's worth of labor. So how can you rise to the occasion every day for the next, you know, 350 days? It's like, that's terra incognita for me. I don't know whether that's, you know, can happen, or is going to happen, or it's just going to be a slog where at the end you go, okay, well, this is what I need to do to make it better. I just don't know. Right. So, I think that every single story that I've written that's good, I kind of don't know how I did it.
Interesting. How did that even, I mean, I remember looking at that. I'm from New York, and I remember that picture vividly, and I shared many of the thoughts that you sort of expressed in kind of narrating that story. Did someone come to you with that picture and say, let's find who this guy is? Is it as basic as that?
No. The New York Times came to me with that picture on September 12th, you know, 2001. I opened it up. I was on page 7, and I looked at it, and I knew, you know, right away that I was going to be writing that story.
Why? Wait, what? How did you know? How did you know? That's interesting.
Because I you know, I think that there, you know, with that story, and I'm, you know, I hope that I'm not getting into, you know, sort of you know, the voodoo part of writing. But I mean, with that story, I looked at that picture and the hair stood up on my arms. And I waited 2 years to write that story because I just, you know, I just wasn't ready to write the story. You know, when it happened in 2001, it would have been a really, really different story. But when I wrote it in 2003, you know, when I wrote the first sentence, the hair stood up in my arms. And, you know, that's what that story was.
But the first sentence of the story I have in front of me is in the picture, he departs from the earth, from this earth, like an arrow.
Yeah.
Was that an obvious, is that an obvious, like, I feel like a lot of times, I teach journalism, and a lot of times young journalists, they get very complicated and they get very, well,
yeah,
how
yeah.
Do you feel like this is as simple, here's the picture and he's falling straight?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what it was. I mean, it was just, I mean, you know, it was one of those stories where, you know, the process of elimination, was very obvious straight through. I mean, you know, there's so many choices that you make in writing a story, and you know, most of the time the process of elimination is a combination of guesswork and, you know, intuition. With that story, it was all intuition.
Interesting. I don't know if you work this way. Is there any level of method acting to writing? And what I mean is, You're working on that story. You're digging deep into the story. Are you picturing what it's like to be him? You know, is that in your head like a lot? What is it like to be falling from a building? What is it like to knowing you're going to die? Is it important to even have those thoughts in your head? Does that matter at all?
Yeah, I don't really, you know, I don't really think too much when I'm doing that stuff. I mean, I try to write sentences, and the thought is in the sentences. You know what I mean? It's not like I sit there and you know, have that thought and then do it. I kind of do it and then have that thought. So it's kind of why I don't outline. It's why I don't structure, and it's why I often pay the price for that in really, really comprehensive, painful rewrites, radical rewrites. And you know, because I just kind of feel my way through it. You know, John McPhee has that book, Draft Number 4, came out, which is a compilation of those sort of how-to essays that he did for The New Yorker over the last couple of years. And I just, you know, I mean, he relates such a sort of painful but straight-ahead course that I can't even relate to it. It has no bearing on what I actually do. And I mean, so his is sort of like the painful straight ahead course. Mine is just sort of the painful course.
Do you enjoy it? Like, do you enjoy the writing?
I enjoy the concentration. I enjoy the level of concentration that you can have, where you know your brain is like this tumbler, you know, it's like this lock, and the tumblers are always sort of flying around, and it feels almost like a random process. Like if you just, like, you know, like in those movies, like where they show, you know, a computer trying to figure out a problem, and it's really just sort of, you know, it just lands on the one, and then after a zillion, you know, different integers flying by, it lands on the three, and then it lands on the four, and then all of a sudden the lock opens. It's kind of like that. It's, you know, you just thinking about it constantly, and you think about it so much, it would be sort of shameful if you couldn't write a story.
Did you, you know, I interviewed Wright, and one of the stories he talked about was he wrote a piece about finding this one guy who fought Muhammad Ali, and he couldn't find him, and it took him years, and it ended up being all about the journey to find this guy.
Yeah.
How important was it for you to find who the man in the photograph actually was, as opposed to the journey of finding who he was?
It was pretty important, I think. I never intended to do a journey of finding the guy story. I mean, there's a lot of great stories that have been written, you know, the journey of finding the guy. But I didn't want that story to be, of that, you know, of that genre. And, you know, and I think that the payoff of sort of finding the guy was really just enormous. It was the Briley family. and you know what they were able to bring to it and what they were able to tell me was just, you know, I mean, it was, it's like, what, you know, here goes the hair standing up on my arms again. You know, I mean, it was remarkable.
Do you still think about that story a lot, or is it one of those?
All the time.
You do, and not just because people bring it up; like it just pops in your head.
Yeah, plenty of times. I mean, I've never lost that feeling. I've never lost the feeling of awe, of looking at that picture, of thinking of those people, and you know, and of the experience of writing it. I mean, the experience of writing it, kind of fills me with awe because it's not something that happens that often.
When are we allowed, like you kind of touched on this in the story and I thought it was very interesting. Like the, there was a Canadian journalist who approached one of the families earlier and got a very stern sort of rejection from them. And I was thinking about this and, you know, we're 2 days removed from the Las Vegas shooting. And if a young journalist or any journalist wanted to do a piece about one of the people who was shot, how do you know when to approach, when not to? Is there a sensitivity that needs time? Is it, should you, I hate to use, you know, cliche, strike when the iron is hot. Is there a way to know when to go after a story and you think maybe when this just isn't right?
You know, I think there's a couple of things that you need to remember. I mean, number one, I mean, I just, you know, for when journalism works, I do think that, you know, the transaction between the story giver and the storyteller can be and should be a pretty profound human transaction. But it is a human transaction in that it's, you know, heir to all the, you know, mistakes, pitfalls, and struggles of that. So, I mean, I think that that's like the thing that you have to remember is like, I mean, try to be a human being. But I think the second thing is that, you know, I mean, I'm amazed by how new it is every time I go out. I mean, there is, it's why I distrust, you know, kind of manuals on the level of like the John McPhee book. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is any how to. I just think it's just sort of a blind stumble most of the time where you're just trying to go on, you know, sort of some basic rules of, you know, decency, intuition, opportunity, all those different things. And they all play a different role in different stories.
I read The Greatest at Rest last night. Your piece about sort of the end of Muhammad Ali, and which this is going to sound weird. So I read The Falling Man. I'd read it long ago, and I read again, and then I read The Greatest at Rest, and I thought The Falling Man was absolutely amazing. And I actually think I like The Greatest at Rest even. I was blown away by The Greatest at Rest. I thought it was one of the best pieces I've ever read, of this genre. And what I just kept thinking to myself, and I wrote it down a million different places. I'm literally looking at this story is, how are you here? How are you here? How are you here? You're, you know, describing the detail of the, you know, the him being wrapped, of his, the way his head is turned. How are you there at the end of Muhammad Ali's, I mean, after his life ended, at the end?
Well, I mean, I was there because the people I spoke to were there. You know, they gave me that. And there was no doubt when I was doing those interviews that they were giving me those experiences, and they regarded those experiences as holy, and I was to regard them as holy in return. I mean, that was, I mean, speaking once again of the hair on your arm standing up. I mean, it was just one of those things where people would be talking to me and I'd get chills. And, you know, I mean, there's no substitute for that. You know, there's no substitute for that experience and that kind of deep, you know, unspoken knowledge. And that was the kind of the guiding light through, you know, the writing and the reporting of that story. It wasn't just in the writing, it was in the reporting.
I just want to read a part real quick. You wrote, Shakir suddenly finds himself in the grip of spontaneous necessity. He's been watching the pulse in Ali's neck, watching it surge with life after he started breathing on his own, and then watching it slowly ebb. And now he leans over, and with his mouth close to Ali's right ear, he sings, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger." When you are, this is something I think a lot of people actually struggle with. When you are interviewing someone and he or she is saying, "Oh yeah, I was there." Mm-hmm. And you want to know if the t-shirt the guy was wearing was red, or you want to know what the room smelled like, are you an interrupter? Will someone be telling a story and you'll be like, "Wait, so was he wearing a, do you remember what the t-shirt looked like? Are you taking notes and asking at the end? Like, how are you making sure to check off your details?"
You know, I'm kind of letting them tell the story. And then if the question pops up sort of, organically as he is telling it, I will sort of allow, you know, that, you know, to be, you know, meaning that I generally don't say, and, you know, I won't say, "Wait a second, was his t-shirt red?" I'll say, you know, "And his t-shirt was red."
know? Right.
And that's it, you know, and those are kind of two different things. I try to stay in the flow of the conversation. I'm really glad that you liked the Ali piece, by the way.
It was
an incredible experience doing that story.
Why do you feel like, so The Falling Man goes down as all time classic, and The Greatest Arrest probably goes down as a story that people read, enjoyed, but there's been so much written about Ali that maybe it gets lost and hit, who the heck knows? Like, do you sometimes feel like, "Hey, wait a second, this story over here, it's really good too," or do you not care?
Oh yeah, of course I care. Yeah. I definitely would love for, the greatest that rest to be read, you know, in the same kind of light that, you know, The Falling Man is. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, Ali, you know, for all his greatness, you know, is a man. The Falling Man is representative of so much else. And so people read that story in a different way. It's been an amazing thing. I mean, every year that story is posted, and every year, I mean, the readership is, you know, it's off the charts, and people go to read it to find out what they felt and feel about that day. And I mean, there's been no greater gift to me as a journalist than that.
Right. There was something I'll go back to that real quick, the Falling Man, because there was one point, and in a way it relates to both stories, because you have Ali, you can make the argument in his most vulnerable, or his, you know, yeah, least sort of enticing viewpoint, which is dead on a table. And you wrote in The Falling Man a lot, which I really liked and hadn't thought about that much, this idea that we're not supposed to look at these pictures because someone has decided we're not supposed to look at these pictures. And it's okay to see deceased firemen being carried out of a building.
Right.
But we're not. And I kind of felt like, but I could be wrong here, you were almost like, "What the fuck? This is such bullshit. Like, why aren't we allowed to look at these pictures?"
Right. Right.
No, yeah. Am I misreading the anger there, or the annoyance? I don't know what the problem
is. I don't know if it was annoyance, but I definitely, I mean, when I was writing that, I was definitely looking to, you know, to make people feel it, even if, you know, some of those sentences, you know, hurt to read.
Right. Do you, I talked this,
but it wasn't out of, anger. It was just sort of, I wanted to communicate, you know, that sense of awe, and, you know, and it's same with Ali. I mean, there's a part in the Greatest at Rest where, you know, his body is being washed, and it is, you know, I'm going to just use the same word, is a moment that, I mean, when I spoke to the body washer, I knew I had the story from that point on, because I had that moment where what I thought of Ali sort of found its measure in this ritual that just made, you know, once again, the hair stand up in my arms when the body washer was telling me that story. So
do you, I wrote a story, earlier this year, about a basketball player in Dallas who was shot and killed entering the wrong apartment. And yeah. His name was Bryce DeJean Jones. And he played for the Pelicans, and he thought he was on the fourth floor, but he entered an apartment in the third floor. Mm-hmm. And I tracked down the shooter. And so he just accidentally walked into the wrong apartment. The guy happened to have a gun. And I wrote this whole story, and I wrote a lot about the shooter and his perspective. And the family of the basketball player was furious with me, absolutely mm-hmm. furious. They felt violated. Mm-hmm. They felt like I crossed a real line. They thought, mm-hmm. you know, I told them from the beginning, I really wanted to write the true story of what happened and who he was. And I think mm-hmm. they didn't really like the true story of what happened and who he was.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much do you worry, or do you at all, about upsetting people, crossing a line that people did not think would be crossed, et cetera, et cetera? And has that happened to you in your career?
Yeah. I mean, it happened with the Ali story. Lonnie Ali was not happy that the description of him dying is in there. She, for reasons that are not known to me, did not want that printed. And, you know, it was, and she wasn't mad at me. I think she was mad at the imam who shared it with me, but she was mad. And I mean, so the question, your question is a great question. It's a central question. But it goes back to what we were talking about before, about this being, you know, a very, very human transaction. And so, yeah, I mean, I think about it all the time. I mean, I worry about hurting people's feelings, about violating, you know, the trust that they've given me, about adding to the, you know, and because a lot of times you're talking to people in journalism who are in pain.
Right.
And so I worry about adding to their pain, you know. But then I generally, you know, move forward because I operate from, you know, what I hope is, you know, is a completely non-cynical place, which is, you know, I mean, these things happen on Earth that inspire anger, reverence, awe, whatever. And if you can write those things, I think it's a good thing in general. So I try to write them.
So do you get the call from Lonnie Ali? Is there an awkward phone call that happens?
Yeah, I got the call from her PR man, with whom I was friendly and am friendly. But I definitely get those calls. I mean, I remember where I was when I got that call. So that's how much it affected me.
Where were you?
I was in a place where I was trying to do research for a book I'm writing, and I was in an incredibly kind of, you know, it was a fairly difficult place because of the nature of the book I'm writing. And I got a call from, you know, Lonnie's PR guy basically saying that, you know, Lonnie's really upset, and it definitely turned me around that day. I mean, I went back to, you know, my hotel and did some contemplation rather than going out for it.
I hate those calls. Those are my least favorite. Of all the calls, those are the worst.
Yeah, because I mean, I have tremendous respect for Lonnie.
Right. Yeah, those are the worst. You I told you this, or I wrote this on Twitter the other day, but I randomly was in my office and I was digging through old stuff, and I found this sort of black and white ancient Staples or rusted, it's right in front of me, profile you wrote for Esquire in 1998 about Mr. Rogers.
That made me feel 100 when you posted that.
Yeah.
It looked like a Matthew Brady photograph from the Civil War.
Oh my God.
It made me feel like 150 years old.
Yeah. It smells like it too. It's pretty
weird. It's very funny.
I love this story. Oh, I love this story. This story, I was reading it, I was laughing out loud. And what I really liked, and again, I know it might feel like a different life. This is 19 years ago when you wrote it, but just the lead. Once upon a time, a little boy loved a stuffed animal whose name was Old Rabbit. It was so old, in fact, that it was really an unstuffed animal. So old that even back then, with the little boy's brain still nice and fresh, he had no memory of it as young rabbit or even rabbit. So old that Old Rabbit was barely a rabbit at all, but rather a greasy hunk of skin without eyes and ears, with a single red stitch where its tongue used to be. So I was telling my wife about this, how you basically wrote this story in a voice similar to what Mr. Rogers' voice would be were he writing the story, in that kind of simple bass tone for kids. I always, it's hard to pull that stuff off. And yet you did. And I don't know how, but you did.
Well, that was definitely not one of those stories that, you know, came to me and, you know, every sentence seemed, you know, was not down on paper until it seemed right. And then, you know, all of a sudden the story is ending. That was definitely a trial and error story. That was definitely, you know, a story that, you know, required a lot of the expenditure of a lot of words to get to the words that were on the page. I remember that. It was, you know, definitely kind of a struggle. And I'm trying to, I'm pretty sure that I tried to do the childlike voice from the very beginning, but it definitely took a while for that to be more than an affectation, you know, and it eventually did, but it definitely took a while.
Is writing like someone like Mr. Rogers, for you, is that the kind of assignment where you're like, okay, or you're like, yes, immediately, let's do it?
Well, that was a strange opportunity, because it came out of like my first real sort of like disaster as a writer, which was the cover story we did at Esquire when I first got there about Kevin Spacey.
And why was that a disaster? I haven't done my research.
Well, because we sort of coyly outed him in that piece. Uh-huh. And you know, and it's, you know, is it okay to write about someone's sexuality without their consent? Well, maybe there is, but certainly not the way I did it.
Interesting.
And because it was just kind of like, you know, I just got an Esquire. I was, I'd been, recruited to go there from GQ, where I'd had really nothing but success. And then I did this story, and definitely there was like a sort of bravado to it. Definitely a sort of, gee, aren't I being cool here? Aren't I being, you know, kind of badass? And the story just blew up in my face. And,
how did that manifest itself? I'm just interested real quick.
It manifested itself with Kevin Spacey calling for me to be blacklisted from doing, you know, further celebrity profiles. It manifested itself with, an incredibly hostile interview with, I think it was Inside Edition, if I'm not mistaken. You know, one of the so-called tabloid TV shows that were kind of in vogue back then. It manifested itself with people just like, you know, just hating it and hating me, you know. I thank my lucky stars that, you know, Twitter hadn't been invented there, because I definitely would have broke Twitter that day.
Right.
But anyway, it was just like, I think back on it, you know, fairly often, in that it was just a story that was, that whose motivation I don't think was pure. So,
so you blame yourself. Out, like, you look back and think, I suck.
I do.
Yeah,
I do. You know, I mean, if you read it now, maybe I haven't read it. I have the cover on my office wall, so that I'm always reminded of like what can go wrong. But anyway, so I wrote that, and then we were going to do this Heroes issue for Esquire, and one of the assistant editors there, you know, thought it would be like, you know, wouldn't this be really interesting if we got Tom to do the Mr. Rogers story? Because, like, wouldn't that be cool? Like, the, you know, the bad guy doing a story about the good guy. And I think that, you know, once again, I had the choice there, whether I was going to do this sort of snarky story full of sort of, you know, bad guy bravado, or whether I was gonna just kind of take what Fred gave me. And that's what it turned out to be. I mean, you know, I was in trouble as a writer when I went to see Fred, and I was in trouble because I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Was I supposed to be this sort of, you know, notorious guy, or was I gonna be sort of, you know, true to myself, really. And, you know, Fred gave me no choice in that matter. Fred wouldn't answer a single one of my questions. I spent a lot of time with Fred Rogers, and, you know, and he would, you know, I would ask him a question, and, you know, he'd be like, well, I don't know, Tom, how do you feel about it? You know, and, you know, he never, I mean, and I mean this literally, he never answered one of my questions. So I was, he focused on me the whole time, and he focused on me the whole time because he knew I was in trouble. And that's what made the story, what, you know, what the story was.
Now, what if you, serious question. Number one, you're doing a profile on Fred Rogers. Do you do a background check on Fred Rogers? And number two, what if you find out Fred Rogers got arrested for solicitation back in 1972?
Well, then it would be a really different story, but I didn't do any kind of background check on him at the time. And, you know, I as it turned out, I don't think I had to. I don't think he actually was arrested for solicitation back in 1972.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah.
I think he was. He was one of those few people that you meet who are exactly, you know, kind of how they portray themselves to be, with all the eccentricity and weirdness of that. You know, I mean, Fred was not a regular, you know, person. Right. He wasn't like, you know, one of the guys by any stretch of the imagination. So. So I got lucky with that. I think that now I'm a little bit more careful. But, you know, I mean, I'm working on a story right now for ESPN in which I set out to do one kind of story, did not really do a lot of background checking on the subject, and it has been just a nonstop carnival of surprise.
Isn't that good though? Isn't that a good thing?
I think it's great. Right. I think it's like the best thing that can happen to you as a writer.
Right. I would say one of the flaws in the book writing process is you write this proposal telling them what the book is going to be about, and you really should have no idea what the book is going to be about.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that that's why, you know, I've never written a book. So the book that I'm writing now at this fairly advanced stage of my career is my first. And one of the things that has always scared me off books is the proposal.
Right.
For that reason. Right. I mean, what is revealed to you as a writer as you sit down and start writing seems so essential that I can't even imagine starting writing knowing what's in store.
I would agree. But if you think that's the worst part of writing a book, wait till you have your first signing at the Bedford, New York Books a Million, and they forget to advertise it. That'll be great. You'll love that.
Well, but I'll steal myself by watching Spinal Tap. You know,
the best is when you're at the signing and there's one guy there and he doesn't even know the signing's going on, and he sees you're sitting at the table and he feels really bad for you. So he talks to you, but doesn't actually buy the book. He just talks to you. That's always great. Let me ask you a final thing. And we touched on this briefly, but then we got disconnected. You and I are both products of what would be called not mainstream journalistic institutions. You SUNY Albany, me University of Delaware. We don't have, you know, I when I got to SI, it used to be, there was this thing, the Princeton Pipeline.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
It would be, right. You know, all these guys from Princeton. And I always had a chip on my shoulder and a little bit of a go fuck yourself kind of thing about having gone to Delaware. And Albany was my second choice. So you must really have that going to Albany. Did you, do you wear that with you? Is that something you wear?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. You know, it's, you know, like in The Falling Man, there's like this thing where, like, you know, you shouldn't be looking at this photo. And the story is something of a reaction to that. Well, I mean, you know, my reaction to being in like the offices of Esquire or something is, you know, you're not supposed to be here either. You know, you're not supposed to be here, being a graduate from a state school. So, you know, I've never quite, you know, lost that feeling of that I'm, you know, encroaching on turf been declared off limits without my knowledge. So yeah.
Right. The Great Danes of Albany.
the Great Danes.
Yeah.
And the Blue Danes. But I think that I just think that that's just such a, you know, I think it's a fairly important thing. I'm pretty motivated, and have remained pretty motivated throughout. That's never gone away. And I think that the Albany experience has something to do with that.
I don't know if you felt this. I certainly did. Like when I went to Delaware, they're like, all right, you want to cover men's basketball? Go cover men's basketball. You want to cover so-and-so? You know, and you go to a Syracuse or a Northwestern, there's a waiting line. There's a line. You have to wait. Maybe you'll start on cross country or whatever. Maybe you'll do something small. And I do feel like when you go to small schools, you're not going to have the alumni connections, but you're going to get the opportunities.
Yeah, I didn't take those opportunities. I didn't write for the Albany ASP was the student paper.
Right.
And I didn't write for that except for some sort of like kind of, you know, super highly literary short essay or something like that. I forget exactly even what I wrote about. It might have been like a book review.
Right.
But I didn't even take advantage of that. But I did, you know, I mean, the thing that has struck me now that I'm writing a book that is, you know, touches upon, you know, my life back then, is that I really, really wanted to write, and really more than wanted to write, I needed to write. I mean, my wife found a box of, you know, some of my old papers, and there were these index cards, these business cards from when I was selling handbags, from Felipe handbags with my name on it. And they were covered with microscopic writing in microscopic handwriting.
Wow.
Where I was just covering these cards in writing. And you know, and there's that German writer, Robert Walser, who eventually, you know, went to the sanitarium. And he was, you know, had written novels and stuff, and he went to the sanitarium and just like kept on writing, but writing like smaller and smaller and smaller until he like literally like disappeared into it. And I look at it, and it's like kind of upsetting, because like my handwriting is not that much different in these things. I was really, really, you know, somewhat maniacal about it.
Right. This is a final awkward question, but can you hook me up with a handbag? Do you know anyone? Is there anyone you can hook me up with? I would love a handbag.
You know, the United States handbag industry, such as it was, is pretty much gone. But yes, I can take you to 330 Fifth Avenue, which is now in what is called Koreatown, but mm-hmm. used to be in the handbag district. And there are still some handbag businesses there. And if you want to get a really nice purse as a gift for somebody, I would definitely be able to hook you up.
You know a guy.
I know a guy who knows a guy.
Right.
For sure.
Well, listen, Tom, seriously, thank you so much for doing this. I'm a huge admirer of your work, obviously, and I really appreciate the time here.
Oh, it was great talking to you. It was a lot of fun.
I want to thank today's guest, Tom Juno, for joining me on Two Riders Sling and Yang. You can follow Tom on Twitter at Tom Juno. One can listen to Two Riders Sling and Yang on both iTunes and on bumpers.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. Again, the music is from the legendary MC White Owl. Thank you so much for joining me. And remember, keep writing.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.